Feel like you're stuck in career limbo? Clock in, clock out, repeat. No growth, no new opportunities. It's time to break out and break into tech. With CBT Nuggets, you can start building the IT skills that companies are hiring for right now. We make training fast, simple, and practical. From networking to cybersecurity, you'll get short, easy-to-watch videos and hands-on virtual labs so you can build real-world skills without expensive gear or complicated setups. For just $59 a month, you get unlimited access to our full training library. That includes certifications, skill-based learning, and practice exams, a $100 value included free. Learn anytime, anywhere, and get job ready on your terms. Thousands have used CBT Nuggets to launch new careers, and you can too. Right now, CBT Nuggets is offering a free trial. Easily find the training you need and test it out with no commitment. Start your 7-day free trial now at cbtnuggets.com. Don't wait. A better job is just a few clicks away.
In 1985, Who's Who, the definitive directory of the DC Universe, combined a new piece of art with a text entry to create a brisk monthly comic book format encyclopedia covering the characters and concepts of the world that Superman built. The last volume of Who's Who was released in 1992, right around the time I began to make DC Comics my publisher of choice. I'm Diabolu Frank. I'll be recruiting a cadre of expert secret agents to take up the gauntlet thrown down by Who's Who on its 40th anniversary via its successor volumes, The DC Secret Files and Origins. This show intends to spend its first year looking backward to the very beginning of the DC Universe until we turn back around to work our way, month by month, toward the Chromium Age DC Secret Files, the definitive podcast of the DC Universe, 1993 through 2011. Be there for the premiere on April 2nd, launching as part of the JS April 2025 multimedia crossover event. Available on the All Ages 4-color Rolled Spine feed.
Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasting.
Abgenommen, bedauert.
Frequency. And thank you all for tuning in, and welcome back to the Graveyard Shift, your place for stories of the unknown here on the Mystery Frequency. And if you're listening to this at night, give yourself some bonus points. If you want to reach out, please do so the usual ways. All those links can be found in the description. And if you enjoy this podcast, please consider following, reviewing, leaving a 5-star rating, and sharing the podcast with anyone you know. Now, our shift has started here at the Mystery Frequency, so let's not keep the strange waiting.
In the dream, you are falling, lost in the listening distance, as dark locks in. Nightfall.
Good evening. The handling of volatile chemicals has always struck me as an occupation that I would prefer others to undertake. Tonight's play, featuring a less than fragile performance by Colin Fox, is called Hands Off. There. That'll hold them. For a while. They can't get in. But I can't get out.
It's a cage! All my life I've kept animals in cages. Now I've put myself in one. Here. By my own hand. My hand. Oh, God, my hands. One touch of nature makes the whole world kin. How can we know what we're touching? It was just an ordinary experiment. How could I know? How could I have known? Go ahead, Sylvia. Touch the cat. She isn't dangerous yet. Why are you so nervous? Touch her.
I'm sorry, Dr. Stryker. I'm not concentrating.
Lab assistants should not get engaged.
I always wanted to get married in May, but Jim says it'll interfere with his bar exams. It's so fresh in the spring.
Delightful. No doubt Jim will welcome the break.
He works too hard, if you ask me.
Nothing wrong with work. Speaking of which, is the observation sheet ready?
All set. Control experiment 361.
Fine. Now, if this solution has the desired effect on that cat's relationship with its kitten, it should also succeed in the operative environment.
I'm still not sure I understand.
It's quite simple. This solution should function as a negative bait.
Negative?
A bait which arouses the desire to kill.
Oh.
If we now observe that our test solution produces a high level of hostility between so intimate a pair as this mother cat and her own kitten, then think of the effect it will have on the primordial savagery of a shark.
But why sharks?
As a control factor, to distract them from human prey. A diver, for example, could launch a decoy saturated with this compound, and every shark for miles around would ignore him and attack the decoy. Now, just a few drops in that kitten's ear, if you please.
What a lovely fragrance.
I'm thinking of calling it rose water. A trade name, perhaps. But be careful. It takes effect through the sense of smell. Keep your mask on. I think you'll be surprised by its potency.
How's that?
Should do it. Now, let's pass Junior over to his mum and see how they get along. Good, primary response.
She's highly disturbed.
Excellent.
My God, she's going to...
Better than I'd hoped for.
Doctor, she's mauling the kitten.
Terminate, Sylvia.
What? Ow! Oh! Oh, my God.
Sylvia, what have you done? The solution is all over the floor.
I'm sorry, Dr. Stryker. I was grabbing the kitten.
For God's sake, be more careful. This is a dangerous substance. Quick, let's clean it up. We cleaned it up, and I told Sylvia to go home for the rest of the day. Even then, I should have known it wouldn't be that easy. At the front gate, George, the guard, always had a smile for me when I signed out. But not today. I suppose I was too proud of myself to notice. But humans are more devious than cats. When I got home, my wife Doris was there, of course. Her continued support has always made the long hours worthwhile. But today... I'm home!
Oh, what kept you? Oh, it was all I could do to keep from phoning.
Doris, I've done it. I had to write it up immediately while it was still fresh. The project's a success.
Ah, good for you, dear. Hey, dinner's in the oven.
Hey, give me a kiss. You know, that was the best part of a very exciting day.
Was it? I wish I could say the same.
What's the matter?
What isn't the matter? That's more to the point, isn't it?
Oh, well, perhaps we should go out tonight.
No. No, I think perhaps we should let sleeping dogs lie.
Sleeping dogs lie? You're not making yourself very clear.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm not making myself clear. Dr. Stryker likes everything clear. How's this for clear? I am tired of sitting around like a lonely slob watching Mary Tyler Moore while you play God in your lap.
Doris, this isn't like you.
Oh, don't tell me what's like me. I can smell that cheap perfume from here. What's she like, Andrew? She must be a real prize.
Cheap perfume? Oh, it's my hand.
You're lying.
Calm down, Doris. Look, we had an accident at the lab today.
Can't you ever stop talking about your stinking lab?
Just hold on a minute. I'm going to wash my hand.
We're talking about being clear, and you go off to wash your hands.
You don't understand.
Oh, I understand, all right. Look, if this is all our marriage means to you, that's fine with me.
Doris, our marriage means a great deal to me. Now, believe me, you're merely suffering a biochemical aberration.
I am not.
Now, let me explain. This is just...
No! Let me explain. You know what this is? This is sick and tired of lying in bed at night while you describe how many rats died.
Doris, please control yourself. You'll regret this later on.
That's where you're wrong, Andrew. I'm tired of always regretting everything. Goodbye.
Where are you going? Wait. Doris.
Get your hands off me.
Oh, okay, okay. I'll let you go.
I'm not betting on it. Get out of my way!
I'm not stopping you.
Not that I could have stopped her. I've never seen anyone like that, let alone Doris. By the time she left, she was white as a sheet, pumped with enough adrenaline for a small army. If I'd stood behind the car, she'd have gladly run me down. Well, after all, that's what the drug was supposed to do. But to human beings? I washed my hand with carbolic soap several times, but the rosewater odor wouldn't go away. I burned myself with lye, scrubbed the hand raw, but nothing seemed to work. The chemical crawled into my pores, and the more I worked at it, the more I sweated, and the more I sweated, the more it stank. A sick, sweet smell that apparently intensified. Worry does that to you sometimes. It distorts your perceptions as much as it sharpens them. A temporary solution finally occurred to me. Simple. Just put on a rubber glove to cover the contact area until the effects wear off. I put on Doris's kitchen gloves and congratulated myself. Then it hit me. If chemical residue on organic tissue could have this effect, what about the traces back in the lab? The night cleaner, the watchman, anybody who happened through that room could be in for it. I had to get back there. I was halfway out the door when... I grabbed the receiver. Doris?
Dr. Stryker, it's Sylvia. I'm sorry to bother you, but I had to call someone.
Sylvia, what is it?
Oh, I don't know. First, the cab driver was rude, and then the doorman and the people on the street. When I met Jim, it was horrible. He was so cruel. I had to get away. He followed me. He was like a madman, calling me names and pounding the door. I wouldn't let him in, and he said...
What?
That he was coming back with a gun.
Listen to me, Sylvia. You did the right thing calling me. Now, I want you to smell your hands.
My hands?
Yes. Is there anything unusual about them?
They smell a bit perfumey, like this afternoon. The rose water.
Exactly. We were probably contaminated when we cleaned up the lab spill. Now listen carefully. A lot could depend on it. There's nothing to worry about if you do exactly as I say.
I'm listening.
Have you any rubber gloves?
No. No lab gloves. But I've got the ones I use for the dishes.
Good. Put them on. Tie them tightly around your wrists. They'll contain the effects until we can get to the lab. We'll run some tests, Colvin. I'll pick you up immediately, but don't let anyone in until I get there, okay?
Okay, but hurry, please.
Sylvia! Sylvia!
Jim, you don't understand. Put it down, please!
Sylvia! What's going on in there?
Don't hit me. I can't stand this. No. No more.
Oh, my God. Open up. Sylvia! Are you all right?
Help me. Help me.
What happened? My God. Jim.
He wouldn't go away. I had to let him in.
He's dead, you know.
He wouldn't even talk to me. He just kept attacking me. What should I do?
Nothing.
Dr. Stryker, you told me these gloves would contain the effects.
Give me the gun, Sylvia.
No. No, I don't think I will.
Why not?
Because I don't feel like it.
Give me the gun.
Stay where you are. You really wrecked my life, haven't you?
It's only the rose water making you feel this way. Try to be reasonable, Sylvia. Try to...
Reasonable? You expect me to be reasonable after this?
Sylvia, if we're going to get out of this, we've got to cooperate. Give me the gun.
Oh, nice try.
The neighbors have probably reported the shots already. And when the police find you, reeking of shark bait with two bodies in your room... Look, don't be stupid. Now come back to the lab with me, and we'll get this under control. If you kill me, you're killing your only hope. Now give me that gun.
If I give it to you, how do I know you won't use it? On me.
Then just throw it out the window. We've worked together for more than 3 years, Sylvia, and I've always valued your common sense. Be reasonable. I'll open the window... Now. Well?
All right. There.
And that's that.
Oh, let's get out of here.
No, Sylvia. I've changed my mind. Things are going to be risky enough tonight without you.
No!
With...
No!
There was a chance, just a chance, that no one had seen me. Certainly there was no one in the corridor or in the lobby. But I could still see her face all the way to the street. I had to get to the lab before anybody blundered into the contaminated area. The responsibility was mine alone.
When I got to the compound gate, George was on duty. Good old George. George? George?
Who's that? What's going on there?
It's me, George. Stryker. I've got to get in.
Oh, Dr. Stryker. What are you doing here at this hour?
Something very important's come up. It's got to be taken care of right away.
I'm sorry, sir. I'm afraid you'll have to wait. You know that between 2400 and 0600 hours, absolutely no one's allowed in the compound.
For Christ's sake, George, I wouldn't be here unless it was vital. I've got to get in.
This isn't a playground. You should know better than anyone why we have these safeguards. There's highly toxic materials in there.
Damn it, George, let me in. Look, I'll give it to you straight. There was an accident in the lab this afternoon, and unless I can get in and do something about it, the whole place is in trouble.
You expect me to buy that? I always thought you were an arrogant son of a bitch. But you must really think I'm stupid.
Please, George, believe me. It's my last hope.
Get out of here before I call the police.
Rosewater got to George, did we get to anywhere. I stumbled around for more than an hour, avoiding anything that moved. I kept circling the fence, looking for a way in, but the place was locked tight. I had to have help. Some way away, under a streetlight, I saw a payphone. If I called Bob Ladowski from Chemical Warfare, he'd know what to do if anyone did. Then the dogs picked up my scent. They cut me off and chased me here. Here. To a tool shed. 50 yards from my lab. What? What's that? Sounds like rats coming through the floor. Jesus. Must be a dozen of them. Gnawing through. I need a weapon. Something. Where did I... Yes. Yes. An axe. God. Linda! That'll hold them. How long? God, if I run for it, the dogs will get their turn. Damn stuff won't wash off. Can't even cover it up. Only thing left is... God, no. No. There has to be something. No, it's got to be... I can't cut it off.
My God! The lab. There's a light in my lab. Someone's gotten in. To the Rosewater. Listen to them.
I haven't got much time. And the police. The neighbors. I can't take them all on at once. How could I distract them? How can I ever escape myself? Well, it's a good play. Don't faint. Pick it up and throw it out the window.
Look at this! Smell this! Rat! Rat! Steve!
Stay right there, ma'am.
Well, what's the matter? What's happening?
It looks like somebody, suffocated, I guess.
Suffocated?
in that shed? How?
I'd rather not talk about it.
Officer, what is going on?
Some poor guy chopped off his hand.
His own hand?
Yeah, I'm afraid
so. How about you? You said suffocated. What did he do? Try to eat his own hand?
Look, lady, back off, will you? You're getting on my nerves.
Where?
The research lab. What's the light doing on over there?
You have just heard Hands On by John Graham. Featured tonight were Colin Fox as Stryker, with Jennifer Brown as Sylvia and Marion Waldman as Doris. Also in the cast were Murray Westgate as George, Ruth Springford as the neighbor, and Ken James as the policeman. Our recording engineer is John Jessup, with sound effects by Bill Robinson. The senior script editor is John Douglas, and our production assistant is Nina Callahan. Nightfall is produced and directed for CBC Radio by Bill Howell. And now, here is a final word from your host.
Hello again. Before listening to next week's Nightfall, listeners are advised to eat well and make sure they know the difference between well-fed and fed up.
Old and aged, what do you think of him?
Him, a very fine young man, Master. Got lovely appetite developed. Him live much longer time than last other young man. How much do you think he eat tonight?
We will try him with a late luncheon first, Boulinaire, and then pronounce on his performance. Young men do not always come up to their profession.
What time, Mother? Dine himself?
I don't know. Perhaps not till 9 o'clock. Perhaps not then.
Vanish, Bolognese, and serve!
The Appetite of Mr. Lucraft, based on the Victorian short story by James Rice and Sir Walter Besant, starring Douglas Campbell, Graham Haley, and Abbott Anderson. Radio for heavy listeners. That's next week on Nightfall. Until then, careful of the edge.
Funds for the distribution of this NPR Playhouse presentation were provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Sometimes it feels like the world is moving at hyperspeed and you can't keep up because it's one thing, then another, and don't forget the meeting and the yoga class and the dinner reservation, but then you get into the all-new Nissan Murano, and you feel the breeze from the panoramic moonroof, while the massaging seats melt away the tension of the day. And you realize that sometimes the greatest rush is not rushing at all. Shop the all-new Murano at NissanUSA.com. Panoramic moonroof massaging leather appointed seats are available features.
This is Nelson Olmsted. Sleep no more. Sleep no more. Turn down the lights. Sink back in your chair and don't look into the shadows. In the shadows, there may be moving things. Tonight, it may be, you will sleep no more. Good evening. This is Ben Grauer introducing tonight's tale of terror, told by Nelson Olmsted on the National Broadcasting Company's presentation of Sleep No More. The story of terror can be as simple as a sheeted ghost rattling chains. It can be a complex and hidden world of horror, lurking in such unholy dimensions as only the dead and the moonstruck can glimpse. Or it can be those terrible, fathomless shadows which lie buried deep in the primitive mind of civilized man. And for this evening, well, Nelson Olmsted, tell us about this evening's story.
Once in a while in my reading, I come across a short story so different, so powerful, so well written, that I can't forget it. Our first story tonight is a case in point, written by one of England's masters of the short story art, A.M. Burridge. It's about a man who went out of his way to scare himself to the absolute limit. Listen while I tell you about the waxwork. While the uniformed attendants of Merrimer's Waxworks were ushering the last stragglers through the great glass-paneled double doors, the manager sat in his office interviewing Raymond Hewson, a journalist. The manager was speaking.
Yes, Mr. Hewson. It used to be said years ago that Madame Tussauds would give a man £100 for sleeping alone in the Chamber of Horrors. I hope you don't think that we've made any such offer, Mr. Hewson. However, if you get your story printed in the Morning Echo, there will be a £5 note waiting for you here when you care to come and call for it.
Wow. That's satisfactory.
Fine. But, first of all, it's no small ordeal that you're proposing to undertake. I'd like to be quite sure about you, and I'd like you to be quite sure about yourself. I shouldn't care to take it on. I've seen those wax figures dressed and undressed, and I know all about the process of their manufacture. I can walk about in their company downstairs as unmoved as if I were walking among so many skittles. But I should hate having to sleep down there among them, alone. Well, why? I don't know. There isn't any reason. I don't believe in ghosts. It's just that I couldn't sit alone among them at night with their seeming to stare at me the way they do. No, the whole atmosphere of the place is unpleasant. And if you are susceptible to atmosphere, I warn you that you are in for a very uncomfortable night.
Hewson had known that from the moment when the idea had first occurred to him. His soul sickened at the prospect, even while he smiled casually upon the manager. But he had a wife and family to keep, and for the past month, he had found almost no newspaper work. Here was a chance not to be missed. The price of a special story in the Morning Echo, with a £5 note to add to it. It meant comparative wealth and luxury for a week, and freedom from the worst anxieties for a fortnight. Besides, if he wrote the story well, it might lead to an offer of regular employment. So, he said to the manager, I've already promised myself an uncomfortable night because your murderer's den is obviously not fitted up as a hotel bedroom. But I don't think your waxworks will worry me much.
You're not superstitious.
Not a bit.
But you're a journalist. You must have a strong imagination.
The news editors for whom I work have always complained that I haven't any.
Yeah. There is one condition I'm afraid I must impose upon you. I must ask you not to smoke. Yes, we had a fire scare down in the murderer's den earlier this evening. I don't know who gave the alarm, but it was a false one. Fortunately, there were very few people down there at the time, or there might have been a panic. And now, if you're ready, we'll go. Well, Houston followed the manager through half a dozen rooms where attendants were busy shrouding the wax figures. Beyond these rooms was the murderer's den. It was a room of irregular shape with a vaulted roof. By design, an eerie and uncomfortable chamber whose atmosphere invited its visitors to speak in whispers. The waxwork murderers stood on low pedestals. The manager, walking around with Houston, pointed out several of the more interesting of these unholy criminals, and Houston pointed and whispered, "Who's that?"
"Oh, I was coming to him. And come and have a good look at him. Well, this is our star boarder, Dr. Bourdin."
"Huh? Yes, I think I've heard the name, but I forget in connection with what."
"Well, you'd remember better if you were a Frenchman. For some long while, that man was the terror of Paris, yes, as he carried on his work of healing by day and throat-cutting by night. When the fit was on him, he killed for the sheer devilish pleasure it gave him to kill, and always in the same way, with a razor. After his last crime, he left a clue behind which set the police upon his track. One clue led to another, and before very long, they knew that they were on the track of the Parisian equivalent of our Jack the Ripper. But when he realized that the police were closing about him, he mysteriously disappeared. And ever since, the police of every civilized country have been looking for him."
"Hmm. Yes, well, I don't like him at all. What eyes he's got."
"Yes. This wax figure's a little masterpiece. You find the eyes bite into you? Well, now, that's excellent realism, then. For Bourdette practiced mesmerism and was supposed to mesmerize his victims before dispatching them."
"Huh. I thought I saw him move."
"Yes. You'll have more than one optical illusion before the night's out, I expect. You shan't be locked in. You can come upstairs when you've had enough of it." "Well, good night, Mr. Houston."
"Good night. I'll see you in the morning." The manager left, and Houston got ready for the night. He wheeled the armchair a little way down the central gangway and deliberately turned it so that its back was toward the effigy of Dr. Bourdette. For some undefined reason, he liked Dr. Bourdette a great deal less than his companions. Busying himself with arranging the chair, he was almost lighthearted. But when the attendant's footfalls had died away and a deep hush stole over the chamber, he realized that he had no slight ordeal before him. The dim, unwavering light fell on the rows of figures, which were so uncannily like human beings that the silence and the stillness seemed unnatural and even ghastly. The eyes of Dr. Bourdette's effigy haunted and tormented him, and he itched with a desire to turn and look. At last he could stand it no longer and quickly looked behind him. Among the many figures standing in the stiff, unnatural poses, the effigy of the dreadful little doctor stood out with a queer prominence. Houston looked into the doctor's eyes for one agonized second and turned again to face the other direction. It struck him, in the moment or two while he'd looked behind him, that there had been the least subtle change in the grouping of the figures in front. Houston held his breath for a moment and then drew his courage back to him as a man lifts the weight. He remembered the words of more than one news editor and laughed savagely to himself, saying, "Yes, they tell me I've got no imagination." He thought this was very cowardly and very absurd. They were only waxworks, and they couldn't move. Let him hold that thought, and all would be well. But then, why all that silent unrest about him? A subtle something in the air which didn't quite break the silence and happened whichever way he looked, just beyond the boundaries of his vision. Suddenly, he heard somebody breathing. He swung around quickly to encounter the mild but baleful stare of Dr. Bourdette. No change. Oh, this was a little too much. It was bad enough that the waxwork effigies of murderers should move when they weren't being watched, but it was intolerable that they should breathe. Somebody was breathing. Or was it his own breath, which sounded to him as if it came from a distance? He sat rigid, listening and straining, until he exhaled with a long sigh. His own breath, after all, or if not, something had divined that he was listening and had at that moment ceased breathing. Now, this would not do. This distinctly would not do.
He must clutch at something, grip with his mind upon something which belonged essentially to the workaday world, to the daylight London streets. He was Raymond Hewson, an unsuccessful journalist, a living and breathing man. And these figures grouped around him were only dummies, so they could neither move nor whisper. Still, the gaze of Dr. Burdett urged, challenged, and finally compelled him to turn. Hewson half turned and then swung his chair so as to bring him face to face with those dreadful hypnotic eyes. Hewson's own eyes were dilated and his mouth lifted at the corners in a snarl. And then Hewson spoke and woke 100 sinister echoes. You move, blast you! Yes, you did! I saw you! And then he sat quite still, staring straight before him, like a man found frozen in the Arctic snows. Dr. Burdett's movements were leisurely. He stepped off his pedestal with the mincing care of a lady alighting from a bus. He stepped off the platform and sat down on the edge facing Hewson. And then he nodded and smiled and he said, good evening. He spoke in perfect English with only a trace of foreign accent. I need hardly tell you that not until I overheard the conversation between you and the worthy manager of this establishment did I suspect that I should have the pleasure of a companion here for the night. Now, you cannot move or speak without my bidding, but you can hear me perfectly well. Now, something tells me that you are, shall I say, nervous. My dear sir, have no illusions. I am not one of these contemptible effigies miraculously come to life. I am Dr. Burdett himself. Let me explain. The circumstances with which I need not fatigue you have made it desirable that I should live in England. I was close to this building this evening when I saw a policeman regarding me a bit too curiously. So I mingled with the crowd and I came in here, and an inspiration showed me a certain means of escape. I raised a cry of fire, and when all the fools had rushed up the stairs, I stripped my effigy of the caped coat, which you behold me wearing. I donned it, I hid my effigy under the platform at the back, and I took its place on the pedestal. I own that I have spent a very fatiguing evening, but fortunately, I was not always being watched and had opportunities to draw an occasional deep breath and ease the rigidity of my pose. Oh, one small boy screamed and exclaimed that he saw me moving. I understood that he was to be whipped and put straight to bed on his return home, and I can only hope that the threat has been executed to the letter. I am obliged to the chance which brought us together tonight, and perhaps it would seem ungrateful to complain. From motives of personal safety, my activities have been somewhat curtailed of late years, and I am glad of this opportunity of gratifying my somewhat unusual whim. But you have a skinny neck, sir, if you will overlook a personal remark. I should never have selected you from choice. I like men with thick necks. Thick, red necks. This, which I have in my hand, is a little French razor. They're not much used in England, but perhaps you know them. Yes, one stops them on wood. The blade, you will observe, is very narrow. They do not cut very deep, but deep enough. In just one little moment, you will see for yourself. Now, my friend, you will have the goodness to raise your chin a little. Thank you. A little more. Just a little more. Ah, thank you. Merci, monsieur. Ah, merci, merci. In the morning, the sunrise began to mingle with subdued light from the electric bulbs. And this mingled illumination added a certain ghastliness to a scene which needed no additional touch of horror. The waxwork figures stood apathetically in their places. In their midst, on the center gangway, Hewson sat still, leaning far back in his armchair. His chin was up-tilted, as if he were awaiting to receive attention from the barber. And although there was not a scratch upon his throat, nor anywhere on his body, he was cold and dead. His previous employers were wrong in having him credited with no imagination. Dr. Burdett, on his pedestal, watched the dead man unemotionally. He didn't move, nor had he moved. After all, how could he? He was only a waxwork.
That was Nelson Olmsted and the story The Waxwork by A.M. Burridge. And now you have a second tale for us?
Indeed I have, Ben. You know, the human mind reacts peculiarly under great stress, especially when overcome with fear. It ceases to be normal and goads the body onto fantastic acts of bravery or cowardice. Ambrose Bierce expressed this condition in many of his fine short stories. And the narrative I want to bring you now is about a man whose great fear was the last reaction of his life. It's entitled, The Man and the Snake. Stretched at ease upon a sofa in gown and slippers, Parker Brayton smiled as he read from Morrister's Marvels of Science. It was an ancient book with its archaic English, which stated, "It is a veritable report and attested of so many that there be now of wise and learned none to gainsay it, that ye serpent, his eye, hath a magnetic property, that whoso falleth into its suasion is drawn forwards in despite of his will and perisheth miserable by ye creature his bite." Brayton smiled again as he thought, "The only marvel in the matter is that the wise and learned in Morrister's day should have believed that snakes could hypnotize our human victims." And a train of reflection followed, for Brayton was a man of thought, and he unconsciously lowered his book without altering the direction of his eyes. As soon as the volume had gone below the line of sight, something in an obscure corner of the room recalled his attention to his surroundings. What he saw, in the shadow under his bed, was two small points of light, apparently about an inch apart. They might have been reflections of the gas jet above him in metal nailheads. He gave them but little thought and resumed his reading. A moment later, something, some impulse which it didn't occur to him to analyze, impelled him to lower the book again and look for what he saw before. The points of light were still there. They seemed to have become brighter than before, shining with a greenish luster that he had not at first observed. He thought, too, that they might have moved a trifle, were somewhat nearer. They were still too much in the shadow, however, to reveal their nature and origin to an indolent attention. And again he resumed his reading. Suddenly, something in the text suggested a thought that made him start and drop the book for the third time to the side of the sofa, where, escaping from his hand, it fell sprawling to the floor, back upward. Brayton, half risen, was staring intently into the obscurity beneath the bed, where the points of light shone with, it seemed to him, an added fire. His attention was now fully aroused, his gaze eager and imperative. It disclosed, almost directly under the footrail of the bed, the coils of a large serpent. The points of light were its eyes. Its horrible head, thrust flatly forth from the innermost coil and resting upon the outermost, was directed straight toward him, the definition of the wide, brutal jaw and the idiot-like forehead serving to show the direction of its malevolent gaze. The eyes were no longer merely luminous points. They looked into his own with a meaning, a malign significance. A snake in a bedroom of a modern city dwelling of a better sort is happily not so common a phenomenon as to make explanation altogether needless. Parker Brayton, a bachelor of 35, returning to San Francisco from all manner of remote and unfamiliar countries, had gladly accepted the hospitality of his friend, Dr. Druring, the distinguished scientist. Dr. Druring's house, a large, old-fashioned one in what is now an obscure quarter of the city, had an outer and visible aspect of proud reserve. It plainly would not associate with the contiguous elements of its altered environment and appeared to have developed some of the eccentricities which come of isolation. One of these was a wing, which was a combination of laboratory, menagerie, and museum. It was here that the doctor indulged the scientific side of his nature in the study of reptiles. He loved nature's vulgarians and described himself as the Zola of zoology. His wife and daughters, not having the advantage to share his enlightened curiosity regarding the works and ways of our ill-starred fellow creatures, were, with needless austerity, excluded from what he called the snakery. Architecturally, and in point of furnishing, the snakery had a severe simplicity befitting the humble circumstances of its occupants, many of whom, indeed, could not safely have been entrusted with the liberty that is necessary to the full enjoyment of luxury, for they had the troublesome peculiarity of being alive. In their own apartments, however, they were under as little personal restraint as was compatible with their protection from the baneful habit of swallowing one another. And as Brayton had thoughtfully been appraised, it was more than a tradition that some of them had at divers times been found in parts of the premises where it would have embarrassed them to explain their presence. Despite the snakery and its uncanny associations, to which indeed he gave little attention, Brayton found life at the Druring mansion very much to his mind. Beyond a smart shock of surprise and a shudder of mere loathing, Mr. Brayton was not greatly affected by the sight of a huge snake under his bed. His first thought was to ring the call bell and bring a servant. But although the bell cord dangled within easy reach, he made no movement toward it. It had occurred to his mind that the act might subject him to the suspicion of fear, which he certainly didn't feel. He was more keenly conscious of the incongruous nature of the situation than affected by its peril. It was revolting, but absurd. The reptile was of a species with which Brayton was unfamiliar. Its length he could only conjecture. The body at the largest visible part seemed about as thick as his forearm. In what way was it dangerous, if in any way? Was it venomous? Was it a constrictor? He didn't know. Brayton rose to his feet and prepared to back softly away from the snake without disturbing it if possible, and through the door. Should the monster follow, a rack of murderous oriental weapons hung in the wall from which he would snatch one to suit the occasion. Brayton lifted his right foot free of the floor to step backward. That moment, he felt a strong aversion to doing so. He lifted the foot a little higher by slightly bending the knee and thrust it sharply to the floor an inch in front of the other. He couldn't think how that occurred. A trial with the left foot had the same result. It was again in advance of the right. His hand was grasping the back of a chair, the arm was straight, reaching somewhat backward. One might have said he was reluctant to lose his hold. The snake's malignant head was still thrust from the inner coil as before, the neck level. It hadn't moved, but its eyes were now electric sparks radiating an infinity of luminous needles. Brayton had an ashy pallor. Again, he took a step forward, and another, causing his hand to knock the chair over with a crack. The man groaned. The snake made neither sound nor motion, but its eyes were two dazzling suns. The reptile itself was wholly concealed by them. They gave off enlarging rings of rich and vivid colors, which at their greatest expansion successively vanished like soap bubbles. They seemed to approach his very face, and again were an immeasurable distance away. He heard, somewhere, the continued throbbing of a great drum. The desultory burst of far music, inconceivably sweet, like the tones of an alien harp. He knew it was the sunrise melody of Memnon's statue, as though he stood in the Nile-side reeds, hearing with exalted sense that immortal anthem through the silence of the centuries. Music ceased, rather, it became, by insensible degrees, the distant roll of a retreating thunderstorm. A landscape glittering with sun and rain stretched before him, arched with a vivid rainbow, framing in its giant curve 100 visible cities. In the middle distance, a vast serpent, wearing a crown, reared its head out of its voluminous convolutions and looked at him with his dead mother's eyes. Suddenly, this enchanting landscape vanished in a blank. Something struck him a hard blow upon the face and breast. He had fallen on the floor. The blood ran from his broken nose and his bruised lips. For a moment, he was dazed and then stunned and lay with closed eyes, his face against the floor. In a few moments, he had recovered and then realized that his fall, by withdrawing his eyes, had broken the spell which held him. He felt that now, by keeping his gaze averted, he would be able to retreat. But the thought of the serpent within a few feet of his head, yet unseen, perhaps in the very act of springing upon him and throwing its coils around his throat, was too horrible. He lifted his head, stared again into those baleful eyes, and was again in bondage. What ensued was a fearful scene. The man, prone upon the floor, within a yard of his enemy, raised the upper part of his body upon his elbows, his head thrown back, his legs extended to their full length. His face was white between his gouts of blood. His eyes were strained open to their uttermost expansion. There was froth upon his lips. It dropped off in flakes. Strong convulsions ran through his body, making almost serpentine undulations. He bent himself at the waist, shifting his legs from side to side, and every movement left him a little nearer to the snake. He thrust his hands forward to brace himself back, yet constantly he advanced upon his elbows. Dr. Drury and his wife were at this moment in the library. Their conversation was interrupted by a mighty cry which rang through the silent house like the voice of a demon shouting in a tomb. Again and yet again it sounded with terrible distinctness. They sprang to their feet, the man confused, the lady pale and speechless with fright. Almost before the echoes of the last cry had died away, the doctor was out of the room, springing up the staircase two steps at a time. In the corridor in front of Brayton's chamber, he met some servants who had come from the upper floor. Together, they rushed at the door without knocking. It was unfastened and gave way. Brayton lay upon his stomach on the floor, dead. His head and arms were partly concealed under the footrail of the bed. They pulled the body away, turning it upon the back. The face was daubed with blood and froth. The eyes were wide open, staring, a dreadful sight. Well, he died in a fit, said the scientist, bending his knee and placing his hand upon the heart. And while in that position, he happened to glance under the bed.
Well, good Lord. How did this thing get in here?
And he reached under the bed, pulled out the snake, and flung it, still coiled, to the center of the room, where it slid across the polished floor till stopped by the wall, where it lay without motion. It was a stuffed snake. Its eyes were two shoe buttons. You can turn up the lights now. You can look around you. Nobody is there, really. Everything is all right, isn't it? Now here is Nelson Olmsted to tell us about next week, Mr. Olmsted.
Well, Ben, two ghost stories. One is by Christopher Isherwood, about a man who, for reasons he doesn't understand, is able to get brief glimpses into the future. It's entitled, I Am Waiting. The second, Browdian Farm by A.M. Burridge, might best be described as an old-fashioned ghost story about a haunted house.
You have been listening to Sleep No More, an NBC Radio Network production directed by Kenneth McGregor. Mr. Armstead's albums are recorded exclusively for Vanguard Records. Until next week, when Nelson Olmsted will again be here in person, this is Ben Grauer bidding you good night.
You can win $1,000 in the bandstand contest. Send your name, address, and phone number to NBC New York today.
If you're enjoying this episode, please don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and to share the podcast.
The commercial room of a small provincial hotel. The setting for the story of strange happenings in room number 17.
The doors were all locked. She'd been round and locked them herself. But she was quite certain she saw a tall, thin figure glide past her across the room and vanish.
Oh, go on, old man. She was having you.
Not a bit of it. She was second cousin of an aunt of mine by marriage. Very sensible woman, soul of truth and honor. Mind, I don't believe in ghost stories myself.
Doesn't sound like it.
Oh, look here, old man. I don't think we've met.
Rafferty, fancy goods. Don't often pass this way. Usually stays the Crown, but there wasn't a hope tonight.
Not surprised. The town's packed.
Well, I'm Braithwick, a knitwear. This is Peel.
Kitchen furnishings.
How do you do?
Yes, you're right. King's Head for me every time. A daft girl at my office forgot to make a booking. And they won't even look at me.
Too bad. But I didn't mean to interrupt in there.
Ah, it's all right. No, what I was about to say, from the journalistic point of view...
I thought you said you...
I was once advertisement manager of the Bradford Woolen Goods Journal, before I came on the road. And speaking from the journalistic point of view, I hold that when it comes to ghost stories, they've all been written over and over again. But when it comes to a bit of realism, then what's needed is an open mind.
Realism. That's what the public wants nowadays. Now, look at some of these plays they put on. I sometimes wonder what the public's coming to if that's the sort of thing
You never can tell with the public. It's like in the fancy business. You never know how it's going to be 1 month into the next.
Yeah, that depends who you are.
Huh?
A name of Little.
Oh, how do you do?
How so? You a regular here?
Oh, I wouldn't say that. Off and on, you know. What I mean is, if you've got the right push about you, you can make anything go.
Oh, true enough.
Now, that story you were just telling, now, that's supposed to be true. But to me...
I assure you, old chap, my aunt's cousin...
Oh, I'm not casting aspersions. I just mean, to me, it wasn't real because there weren't half enough details there. You didn't say when it happened or what the room was like.
Well, you can't expect...
Or what happened afterwards. What I like... is a story about what a man's seen himself.
I'm with you there.
Now, I could tell you a story.
Not another ghost. Hallucinations, that's all it is.
No, no, let him go on.
Well, if you like. At any rate, it's not one of these somebody fancied they saw a kind of a something stories. Everything I'm going to tell you is as plain and straightforward as a timetable. Plainer than some.
Let's hear it, then.
Well, to start with, did any of you know Robert Hatteras?
Hatteras? What line?
Well, I forget now. He was on the road a good many years.
Never heard of him.
Well, it doesn't matter anyway. Well, he was a good chap. Ex-RAF. Big moustache, you know. Mind you, I didn't know him myself.
I never heard of him.
What happened took place at a certain commercial hotel. I won't give it a name because that sort of thing gets about.
Uh-huh.
Whether he did it himself, nobody knew. But they found him on his bedroom floor with his throat cut. Well, sometime later...
Yeah, hold on. What was all that about not filling in the details?
you got me there. Well, there wasn't anything specially rum about the room, I believe. Now, let's see, there was a sort of French bed with carvings all over it, and a big black wardrobe the size of a hearse with a glass door, and a sort of oriental mirror with a black frame screwed up between the windows. Oh, yeah, and a picture of the Feast of Belshazzar over the mantelpiece.
What?
Pardon, old man?
Oh, nothing. Go on.
Let's hear the story.
Well, as I was saying, sometime later I found myself in... But I'd better not mention the name of the town either. I found my firm had booked me into that very hotel. It was full. But there was quite a crowd of us in the commercial room after dinner. I got chatting to a fellow in the antiques line. Very pleasant chap. Cooper, I think he was called. The place is pretty full tonight, Mr. Cooper.
Oh, I've seen it worse. What room you got, Little?
In number 17.
17? Oh, you wouldn't catch me in there.
Oh, why?
Thought they'd closed it up. That's the room where the chaps cut their throats.
Eh?
Yes, chap called Bert Hatteras began it. You haven't heard about him?
Oh, yes, yes, I did hear.
But since?
Since? Why, was there something else?
Every man who's slept in that room since has cut his throat. Just like poor old Bert.
You're kidding.
Well, I'm exaggerating a bit, maybe. There's only been two more.
Two?
Three, counting old Bert. And I'll tell you another thing.
Yes?
Every one of them was a commercial. Oh, are you going now?
Yes. Well, just a breath of fresh air before I turn in.
Well, pleasant dreams, old man.
Oh, can I help you, Mr. Little?
Yes, you wouldn't by any chance.
Yes?
Any hope of changing my room?
Well, we are rather full. Doesn't it suit you, then?
No, it's just that, you see, it's over the bar, and I thought I'd like to get an early night. Anything would do.
Well, oh, there's number 16. It might be a little bit quieter. I'm afraid
I'll
that's
all, I'll take it.
Though.
I'll shift my own things. I'm sorry to be a trouble.
She didn't let on she knew why you wanted to swap over, then.
Well, I thought she gave me a bit of a funny look, that's all.
Well, let's hear the rest.
Well, I shifted my things. I didn't altogether like the idea of being next door to number 17, but there was nothing else for it. It wasn't till I was taking my collar and tie off that I realised about the furniture.
Well, what about it?
Well, I hadn't taken much notice of the things in number 17, but in my new room I suddenly saw that the bed had carving all over it, that there was a great wardrobe the size of a hearse, and a sort of oriental mirror screwed up between the windows.
Go on.
Yes. And the Feast of Belshazzar over the mantelpiece.
You mean...
I saw that although I hadn't got number 17 anymore, I'd got all the furniture that had been in number 17 when Bert Hatteras was done in.
Oh, but that made you feel good, eh?
I don't mind admitting, amongst ourselves, that when I got back in number 16 again, I looked under the bed and inside the wardrobe.
Anybody hiding there?
No, nothing.
Just a minute, though. Everything you've told us so far about this chap Hatteras and so on... Well, it was only hearsay, wasn't it? That's the point.
Yeah, it's quite true. I don't ask you to believe any of it. But what I'm going to tell you now is my part of the story. What happened to me in that room?
Well, we're all ears.
And I'll admit I had a bit of a struggle with myself. I smoked a pipe and I read the evening paper right the way through, advertisements and all. And then I told myself it wasn't in my room, but in the one next door that it had happened. And at last I... went to bed.
Bet you left the light on.
No, I can't sleep with the light on.
Did you sleep?
Like a top. Until something woke me up. Just a little sort of tapping noise. Who's there? Who is it?
They told me you'd be in number 17.
Who are you? What do you want?
You're Mr. Little, aren't you?
What if I am? Who are you?
Night porter, sir. Your early call. Oh. It's after 6.
Early... Oh.
You did want a call, sir. I've been knocking and knocking next door, you see. Only nobody never told me you moved.
Oh, yes. Yeah, thanks. Thank you very much.
That young thing on the desk, if I told her once, I told her 100 times. If you don't leave a note, how's the night porter to know?
Early call.
Is that all?
I don't think much of that for a story.
Oh, wait a minute. You haven't heard the story yet.
Well, I hope it improves.
It was 6 o'clock on a winter's morning, pitch dark. I got up and put on the little lamp over the wash basin and got dressed. There wasn't a sound anywhere. I had a wash and I just started to shave when I saw something move in the looking glass. It made me jump and the razor nicked into my throat. The big door of the wardrobe had swung open, and by a sort of double reflection, I could see the bed behind me. On the edge of it sat a man in his shirt and trousers, a man with a great big moustache and the most terrible look of despair and fear on his face that I've ever seen or dreamt of. I stood paralysed, watching him in the mirror. I couldn't have turned round to save my life. Suddenly, he laughed. It was a horrid, silent laugh that showed all his teeth. They were very white and even. And the next moment he cut his throat from ear to ear. There, before my eyes. Have you ever seen a man cut his throat? The bed was all white before. When I could look round, I did. There was no one in the room. The bed was as white as ever.
Well, could you slow down?
Don't know how I'd be. Well, that's all. Except that now, of course, I understand how those other poor chaps had come by their deaths. They'd seen this horror, this ghost of Bert Hatteras, you know, and with the shock, their hands must have slipped, like mine did, and they cut their throats before they could stop themselves. Oh, by the way, when I looked at my watch, it was 2 o'clock. There hadn't been any night porter at all. I must have dreamt that. But I didn't dream the other. Oh, yes. And another thing. It was the same room. They hadn't changed the furniture around. They just changed the numbers. It was the same room.
I'll just slip out for a moment. Be back in a minute.
Probably gone to see if he can change his room.
Was my story as good as all that?
First rate.
The bit that doesn't ring true to me is about those other chaps cutting their throats with a shock. I mean, they'd have had to be using cutthroat razors to do it.
Oh, well, yes, I expect so.
Well, there aren't many of these things about nowadays.
Don't you believe it. I use one myself. Always have done. Nothing to touch them.
Oh, do you think so?
Swear by a cutthroat.
Oh, well. Oh, in any case, I mean, all this was some time ago.
Lucky for you, you didn't.
Ah, well, now we'll know. We reckoned you'd gone to ask for another room, old man.
As a matter of fact, I have.
What?
Seriously?
Yeah, they're moving my things straight away. Lucky for me, number 4's had a cancellation.
Well, don't tell us you were in number 16.
I was. And it had that same furniture our friend here described.
No.
And that picture over the mantelpiece.
Oh, dear, I am sorry. The cat's out of the bag, then. Yes, it was this hotel I was speaking of.
Oh, really? What?
I could do with the drink.
No, I'll go. I want a word with the receptionist anyway.
Going to ask them to move you into number 16, your old haunt. Oh, hey, haunt!
Yes, it happens, I am. You see, it's the best room in the house. I always try for it.
What do you mean to say?
As I said earlier, a chap ought to be able to make anything go if he uses the right push.
Well, I know this.
I'll bring the waiter back with me. It's the least I can do. Oh, by the way, you were going to say I was lucky not to cut my throat too. Well, I always use a safety razor. As a matter of fact, they're my line. Safety razors. Won't be a jiffy.
David Kossoff in Number 17 by E. Nesbitt. It was produced by Charles Lefeu and adapted for the BBC by Michael and Molly Hardwick. A chance meeting between old school friends. The simplest thing in the world. But it leads to a revival of the dare game.
Fee-fi-fo-fum, I sniff the whiff of a dare to come.
I beg your pardon?
You are Carol Mayne, aren't you?
Yes, at least I was. Oh, it's Enid. Enid Grover.
That's right.
Good heavens, what an extraordinary thing. How many years is it?
50.
Oh, imagine, we're 30.
I know, isn't it awful?
And school seems like another world.
It's still very vivid to me.
Is it? Oh, not to me. I remember odds and bits. I remember you.
Thanks. I suppose you're married, Carol?
Yes, I'm a doctor's wife.
Children?
2 boys, 7 and 10. What about you?
I'm not married.
Look, Enid, this is so fantastic meeting in the street like this. Have you time for a coffee?
Yes, I'd like that.
There's a place across the road. I've got loads of shopping to do, but I don't come up to the West End very often, but that can wait till afterwards. Sugar, Enid?
No, thanks.
Oh, sensible of you. Tell me, Enid, what are you doing now?
I'm on sick leave. I've been ill.
Oh, I'm sorry. What was wrong?
Nobody quite knew. It was politely called a breakdown. But I shall be back at work next week.
And your work?
I'm in the civil service. Home office, to be precise.
Still?
Why not?
I remember you going in for the exams when we were at school. Janet and Irene did, too. But the last I saw them, they'd left.
Married, I expect.
Yes.
When one doesn't marry, Carol, one goes on working. I've never found anyone willing to support me.
But there's more to marriage than that, you know.
Really?
You haven't changed.
That's all you know.
You haven't, Enid. You were always too clever for me, and you still are. I still feel there's something behind quite ordinary things you say. Funny. I remember that about you. And when I've thought of you since, I've concluded that I imagined it. But I didn't. It's true. You still make me feel naive.
I was the naive one, surely.
You were the most left-headed of the lot of us.
Remember the dare game, Carol?
Fee, fi, fo, fum.
I sniff the whiff of a dare to come.
School's extraordinary. All those hours and hours of lessons and one doesn't remember a word of them. Yet silly things like the way Miss Legging spat as she talked.
Oh,
and
yes.
Those shapeless jumpers Miss Cumber used to wear. And our various scrapes and dares, all remembers them vividly.
Yes.
The worst dare I ever did was spilling that ink in Miss Wilkins' desk. Oh, there was an awful moment when I thought she'd guessed it wasn't an accident.
But you got away with it. I didn't get away with my worst dare, did I?
What was that?
Don't you remember?
We did so many things, didn't we? I've even forgotten some of my own dares.
But you haven't forgotten the ring.
Oh, no. No, that was pretty awful. Oh, but isn't it funny to look back on? We took ourselves so seriously, as if it mattered what happened.
She never believed me, you know.
What?
Miss Gordon, she never believed me. She made a remark on the day I left, which showed that she still thought I was a thief.
Silly woman.
Why silly? No one told her otherwise.
I'm sorry, Enid. 15 years too late, I'm sorry.
So you do remember?
Yes.
Why did you pretend not to?
Guilty conscience. And then, when I dared you that day, I never really thought you'd do it. As soon as I'd said it, I wished I hadn't. Miss Gordon took off her ring, didn't she, and put it on the desk. Then she went over to the sink of the corner of the physics lab and washed her hands.
And you whispered to me our usual challenge. Fee-fi-fo-fum, I sniff the whiff of a dare to come. I dare you, Enid, to take Miss Gordon's ring. So I took it.
I wish you hadn't. There's something that's always puzzled me. When old Gordon began to make a fuss and asked where her ring was and if we'd seen it, why didn't you hand it over straight away? You'd done the dare. There was no reason to hang on to the ring.
I didn't have time to tell her.
Oh, surely.
No, that kid at the back, Lily Carr, she piped up with, Miss Gordon, I saw Enid Grover take your ring. Then Gordon accused me and that was that.
Well, you denied it at first.
Panic. Then she found it in my pocket. And she didn't believe me. Well, she pretended to because she was scared of trouble. But she would have believed me if you'd spoken up and told her about the dare game.
Beastly little coward, wasn't I?
You wanted to hurt me.
Did I?
You know you did. Why?
Enid, I honestly don't know. Kids do things, don't they? Well, maybe I was jealous of you because you were cleverer than I was. Because you had a sort of power over me. I don't know. Come to that, there was nothing to stop you from telling Miss Gordon about the dare game.
I was too proud. I decided to let her think what she liked. I told her it had been done as a joke, and that was the truth.
You know, Enid, you're being a bit kinky bringing up all this stuff that happened when we were kids. What does it matter now?
I think when people do something wrong, like betraying a friend, it stays just as wrong however many years pass.
Maybe, but there's no need to go on brooding about it.
There was never any need for you to brood, was there? You got off scot-free.
So did you? After all, you did take the ring. It was awfully silly of you.
I had no choice.
Of course you had.
But you dared me.
So what? If you dared me to take a valuable ring, I wouldn't have done
it. Oh, yes, you would. That was the dare game. We always carried out each other's dares, always.
Oh, Enid, stop. I can't understand why you're still niggling about it all after these years.
It was the injustice. It was never tidied up.
Okay, let's tidy it up now. I'll buy you a present to make amends. Something pretty. A scarf, earrings, what would you like?
Trying to buy me off for the sake of your conscience?
Oh, don't be such a prig.
All right, Carol. Let's go to the shops now and look at the pretty thing.
Here's the costume jewellery counter. Now what would you like, Enid? There's some nice earrings on this tray. Oh, where's the assistant?
She doesn't seem to be around.
Oh, well, we can be choosing.
B-5-0-Fum. I sniff the whiff of a dare to come.
Oh, no.
I dare you, Carol, to put that pair of green earrings in your pocket and walk out.
Oh, don't be a damn fool. Look, I've offered to buy you a present. Do you want one or not?
B-5-0-Fum. I sniff the whiff of a dare to come. For the second time, I dare you, Carol, to put that pair of green earrings in your pocket and walk out. I dare you, Carol. I dare you.
I can't.
Of course you can. I dare you. You can bring them back afterwards. Go on. Take them. Walk out. And then come back. I'll wait for you here. And then honor will be satisfied for good and all.
All right. It's quite mad, but still, here goes.
Oh, to the manor born. Do you come here often?
Don't watch me as I walk out.
Of course I shan't. I'm going to wait here by the counter. Bye for the present.
If I get caught, I'll blame it all on you. This is what it feels like to be a thief. I'll never do this again as long as I live. Why am I doing it anyway? School day codes die hard, I suppose, like childhood religion. Enid's mad, quite mad. Well, then so am I to be doing this. I do believe that all through my life, if anyone says to me, fee, fi, fo, fum, I sniff the whiff of a dare to come, I'd do whatever they said. Nearly at the doors now. All I've got to do is to get outside. That'll complete the dare. Then I can go back. Swing doors. Open. Outside at last. Oh, no. I've done it. I'll be able to tell John when I get home. Oh, maybe I won't. He'll be furious. Taking a risk like that, he'd say. Oh, now I can go back. Oh, who are you? Take your hand off my arm.
Excuse me, madam, but the manager would like a word with you.
With me? Why?
Please come this way, madam.
But who are you?
I'm the store detective, madam.
Oh, dear.
But come along, through these doors.
Wait a minute. Is it the earrings? Well, here they are.
Thank you, madam.
How did you know?
I saw you.
Oh, I remember seeing you now. I thought you were a customer.
But that is the general idea. Now come along, madam, please.
It was only a joke, you know. I'm not a thief. It was a game I was having with a friend. We used to dare each other to do things when we were kids. The dare game, we used to call it. She dared me. It was a joke. She'll tell you. Oh, Enid.
What's up, Carol?
This lady's a detective. She saw me, Enid. Please tell her about the dare game.
The what?
Tell her that you dared me to take the earrings for a joke.
You took some earrings?
Well, you know I did.
I'm sorry, Carol. I don't approve of shoplifting, even when my friends do it. Leave me out of this.
Now, your friend obviously can't help you, madam, so will you come and see Mr. Marlin, the manager, straight away, please?
But you've got the earrings back now.
This way, madam.
Enid!
Now, come along, madam, please.
All right, but I'm telling the truth. That's exactly what happened, Mr. Marlin. Oh, I know it sounds crazy, but it's true. I've never stolen anything in my life, and I did intend to bring the earrings back again. It was just a joke.
Very well, Mrs. Gray. I will accept your explanation. I don't particularly wish to call in the police, but I'd be glad if you'd keep away from this store in future.
So you don't believe that it was a joke?
As we are taking no action, I don't see why that should matter to you.
But of course it matters. I'm not a thief.
I have a great deal to do, Mrs. Gray, so if you'd care to see yourself out...
Hello. I thought I'd wait for you.
Enid!
How did you get on?
Go away. I don't want to speak to you.
Did you believe you, Carol?
Of course. Otherwise I wouldn't be here, would I?
Oh, bet he didn't.
Oh, he let me go.
That doesn't mean he believed you. So now you know what it feels like. Not very pleasant, is it?
Enid, will you clear off and leave me alone?
Oh, poor Carol. Have I spoiled your nice morning shopping in town?
You've done more than spoil it. The whole thing makes me feel quite sick. Frankly, I think you've gone off your head. Enid... How could you behave like that? You deliberately lied in the shop.
You're so right. But I did more than lie. You haven't looked at me properly.
Looked at you?
Yes. Have a good look.
Those earrings you're wearing. I saw them on the tray in the shop. Did you buy them?
No.
Then how did you get them? You stole them?
Yes. It's evidently something I do better than you. All a matter of practice. I started young, you see, when I took the ring.
Oh, no, Enid, you can't blame everything on a childhood dare. And I don't think pinching things in shops is funny or clever.
From one who's just been nabbed by a store detective, I find that remark rather comic.
Do you often take things?
Whenever I'm in the mood.
Don't you ever get caught?
I was once, in a different town, when I was less skillful than I am now.
And what happened?
I wasn't as lucky as you've been today. The manager sent for the police and charged me. But I engaged a good solicitor, and he engaged an advocate to defend me, and he found a psychiatrist who said it was all due to my frustrations. He got me off.
You paid people to tell lies for you?
Lies? My dear Carol, every word that psychiatrist said was true. It is my frustrations that make me swipe things from shops. I have a perfectly good salary. I could afford to buy anything within reason. But it's so much more exciting to steal things. Women with empty lives have to make their own excitement, you see. It's different for you. You have your husband and children. Don't grudge me my hobby.
Hobby?
Certainly. And I owe it to you, really. If it hadn't been for the dare game, I'd never have got started. And if you had cleared my name in those far-off days, I might never have realized that it's not what one does that matters. It's what people believe about one. You are now regarded as a shoplifter. You won't be welcome in that store again, but I can go in whenever I like. So now I'll say goodbye, Carol. It's been so nice meeting you and tidying everything up.
Margaret Wolfitt and Shirley Cooklin in The Dare Game by Rosemary Timperley, produced for the BBC by Keith Williams.
Thank you again for listening. And please don't forget to follow, review, rate, and share the podcast.